For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, author Sarah J. Harris introduces us to the colours of B. Larkham's murder.
I had this dream about a young boy running across a suburban street at night, terror etched on his face.
Poet Andrew Pettigrew waxes lyrical about heaven in a poke.
Ah, it's heaven in a poke. But wait just one moment, what's that above me?
Candia McWilliam shares insights into blindness, addiction, and literary prizes.
I was what's called functionally blind, which meant that my eyes were fine, but my brain had closed them and it simply would not open them.
And Robert Kirkwood interviews a voice acting legend.
It needed to be stylized and menacing. And then they fed the voice through a synthesizer. So it went like something like that. That fouls.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. Every writer dreams of getting a six-figure book deal. And that's just what author Sarah J. Harris has achieved with her book, The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder. It was snapped up by publishers within days, with film producers already looking to adapt it for the big screen. The novel tells the story of a 13-year-old boy called Jasper who has synesthesia, a condition that means he sees sounds as colours. The teenager, who also suffers from face blindness, believes he is responsible for his neighbour's murder after seeing the colours of her screams. Published just a couple of weeks ago, the book is already drawing praise and comparisons with The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And I wouldn't be surprised if B. Larkham likewise goes on to win awards for both young adult and general fiction. Sarah J. Harris came to our Camden studio to tell us more about the book.
So my book is about a 13-year-old boy called Jasper Wishart, who is quite an extraordinary boy. He has synesthesia, which means that he sees the colour of all sounds, and he also has face blindness, which means that he can't recognise people, even those closest to him. And he sees the world in colour, and one Friday night he sees a terrible colour that traumatises him. He sees the colour of B. Larkham's murder.
And where did the inspiration for the plot come from?
Initially, I've been very interested in synesthesia for years, as I'm a freelance education journalist, and I came across the condition when I wrote a feature about the prevalence in childhood of synesthesia. And it was the first research that had been carried out by Edinburgh University. And the researchers estimated there was one or two children in every single primary school who had chromesthesia, which is the kind of synesthesia my character has, which is sound colour. And they also said about the lack of awareness that very small numbers of head teachers and learning support assistants understood synesthesia or knew what it was. And I interviewed a lady whose 9-year-old daughter has synesthesia, and she was distracted in lessons. A boy would sit behind her in the classroom and whack his ruler on the desk, and she would see the purple colours. And she would try to explain to the teachers, "I can't concentrate, I can't see past the colours." And the teachers just thought she was making it up. So it was difficult, and it really made me think what must life be like for a child if somebody doesn't understand your day-to-day experiences, or perhaps doesn't want to understand it? So that really resonated with me. And I read up lots about it and collected any articles I saw in newspapers and magazines, and also about face blindness, which interested me greatly. And I guess both conditions were I was thinking about a lot. And eventually I had the idea, it came to me in a dream. I had this dream about a young boy running across a suburban street at night, terror etched on his face, utterly terrified. He was so horror-struck that it woke me up, and I knew he'd seen something terrible. And it made me think, what if he'd seen the colour of murder? What if he'd seen the colour of the screams of somebody who was being murdered?
And you throw us right in at the deep end. Jasper, your 13-year-old protagonist, is at the police station, pretty much admitting to having been a part of the murder, and because it's told from his point of view, it's very intense and very, very effective.
Thank you. I loved Jasper, and I lived with him for so long. I dreamt about him, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd go and scribble more notes. So I it was quite an intense experience writing from his point of view, and I was so fascinated by his world, and I still remain fascinated by synesthesia. I remain a member of the International Association of Synesthetes, Artists and Scientists, and there's also a worldwide forum called the Synesthesia List, which is run by Sean Day in the United States, and you get emails every day from synesthetes talking about their experiences. So I'm still kind of immersed in that world, kind of reluctant to let it go.
One of the aspects you've already touched on is that other people, particularly adults, teachers, maybe even parents, can't see the world from Jasper or a synesthete's point of view and get very frustrated with him, even those who love him most. Did you ever find yourself getting frustrated with Jasper as a character in the book?
I did feel sorry for Jasper, and I felt, and then I was doing all these terrible things to him that made it, which made it worse. But I didn't feel frustrated. I didn't feel frustrated for him. He was going through this horrendous experience, and I know that from my dream that I knew I had to have a child protagonist, because what he experienced was so harrowing, and it makes it much worse, I think, if it's a young boy or a girl experiencing it than if it'd been an adult who's able to understand absolutely everything that's going on. And Jasper isn't able to understand everything that is going on. And he is the ultimate unreliable narrator, I guess, that he has pieces of the puzzle and people around him have pieces of the puzzle. And he's slowly trying to put that together, which I think would be, if a 13-year-old boy was going through this, who has difficulties maybe processing what's around him, I think that would be hopefully would be a genuine depiction of what would be taking place, that he wouldn't immediately know all the answers and the people around him wouldn't immediately know all the answers.
I love the parallel investigations that are going on, that the police doing the CSI type of investigation whilst Jasper is trying to piece together what's happened, what he's witnessed. And I think having a protagonist who can't recognise faces is a fantastic, well, I was wanting to say device, and yet I'm also aware that up to 1 in 10 of the population has a degree of face blindness.
There's a huge number. I mean, when I started researching it, I was actually surprised by the numbers. And I think for children, it's a very difficult and can be a very harrowing experience. I mean, the people I've interviewed have all said that at school it was very, very difficult. They were isolated. They would go out into the playground and they couldn't go up to their friend. They didn't know who their friends were. There was a young boy who was being bullied at school and his teachers were getting frustrated because he couldn't tell them who the bullies were. And I just imagine you're walking down that corridor and people are coming towards you and you don't know if they're your friends or if they're the person who's picking on you. And it is very, very difficult for children in schools, that the markers that people who have face blindness use, such as they look at hairstyles or earrings or unusual socks, you don't have that in a school environment. Everybody is wearing identical blazers. They're encouraged to have the same hairstyles. They can't have outlandish, they can't dye their hair pink or things like that. So for children, it is a very, very difficult situation in schools. And there is a lack of understanding or knowledge about it in schools, even now.
That aspect of not being able to recognise people's faces is something that will chime with a lot of read-on listeners. One thing that we find, though, quite often, is that characters with sight loss are given a rather one-size-fits-all type of treatment in books. How did you manage not to stray into caricature? Because there have been a lot of books recently that have dealt with autistic spectrum disorders and disorders like prosopagnosia that are grouped in with that.
I did a lot of research, and I did a massive amount of research into synesthesia and prosopagnosia, otherwise known as face blindness, and autism. So I think because my background as a journalist, I approached it in a journalistic way. So I to begin with, I interviewed experts in synesthesia, and then I interviewed, they put me in touch with a lot of synesthetes who I interviewed, and also with the face blindness. So I had a lot of help from Face Blind UK. They were very helpful, and I interviewed people with face blindness, and I did go back to my contact at Face Blind UK saying, this is what I want to do, this is my plot, is this realistic, this is what Jasper was going to do, this is what's going to happen to him. So I was bouncing back with them. As I was doing it, and the same The same with the National Autistic Society. I'm saying this is what's going to happen. This is what Jasper's going to be doing at school. Is this a realistic portrayal? Is this what would happen to... what kind of assistance would an autistic child get at school? And with the synesthetes, I was bouncing back with... When I realised, when I was writing it, I'd done an awful lot of research before I started writing it. But when I began to write it, I realised that it was kind of an ongoing process and that I kept bouncing back to synesthetes saying, you know, what is the colour you see? I had long lists, like, for each of them, saying what colours do you see when a door bangs, when a car door bangs, an indoor door bangs, footsteps, birds, those kind of things. But so for the face blindness, I didn't, for all of it really, I wanted it to be as, you know, as genuine a portrayal as I possibly could. And the only way I could do that was by speaking to people with the conditions and going through the associations, like the UK Synesthesia Association. It was extremely helpful. Faceblind UK, they were very helpful throughout the process of writing and researching it.
I was wondering, actually, did you keep a list of a car door sounds yes. like this to Jasper, and which you referred back to all the time?
I did. So when I first started researching, I spoke to experts in synesthesia, the foremost experts in synesthesia in this country. And then I went through, the UK Synesthesia Association and Sean Day's synesthesia list put out an appeal for synesthetes. And so I had some really, really helpful people. And I'd asked some initial questions. And then I went back to them with long lists of things just to try and see if they had anything in common with the colours. And I realised from doing that that everybody had different colours for, like, birds, voices, car doors slamming, but the one thing that they had in common was that the colours of voices all changed to when somebody whispered, it was kind of grey, white, wavy lines, and also that for all of them, they said that conditions such as smoking or illnesses could dramatically change voice colours. And so when I realised that I realised that it was so different for everybody. I just knew I could create my own palette of colours for Jasper. So I had massive spreadsheets. And so for every sound in the book, I had a spreadsheet for, like, everyday sounds. So doors closing, a car engine revving, bird sounds, voice colours, music, musical instruments. And then I kept a track of it in the book. And I knew that I had to stay true to my character and to the range of colours. So, for example, if somebody's walking down the street one day and the sound of the footsteps are black torpedo shapes, the next day when that character's walking down the street, they can't be bright lilac shakes. They have to be within that realm of the character's experience, and they're not going to dramatically change. So I had to keep track of it, and it was quite a scientific process. I listed everything by page on the book and made sure that when I was writing it, sometimes when I was writing it, I put X's next to sounds so that I could try and code it back when I'd finished getting the whole plot down. But I was really careful about trying to plot it, because I had been told that by some of the experts I spoke to, that you have to stay true to your character's experience, and anything really is possible. There's such a range of experiences for synesthetes, but you have to stay true to your character, and that's what I tried really hard to do.
And the result is a book full of beautiful, vivid colours, which are also manifested in the parakeets,
yes.
who are another major character in the book. Tell me about the inspiration for them.
I mean, I've always loved birds. As a child, I was a member of the Young Ornithologists Club at the RSPB, and I was always I went bird watching with my dad, and I still know the names of lots of UK birds. I'm always interested in it, I guess. And then where I live in West London, we have huge numbers of parakeets. So when I'm working in my study, I can see and hear them kind of bickering in my back garden. They're in the parks, they're in Kew Gardens, they're in Richmond, huge, huge numbers. And I've always been interested in them. And I had been reading about how they were increasingly seen as a pest in the UK, and how they kind of force out other birds out of their, because they're early nesters, they force out other birds from nests. And I could see as well how it was dividing some communities, that there were neighbourhoods where they absolutely hated the parakeets and really saw them as a pest and as a problem to get rid of. And then I could see others who just loved other people who loved the parakeets, and I thought they were quite a dividing influence, which is reflected in the character of Bea Larkham as well, that she polarised opinion. Jasper absolutely loved her and worshipped her, and other people saw her as an invader on the street, somebody they wanted to get rid of, just like the parakeets. So I saw them quite parallel with Bea Larkham. They seemed to be the perfect bird to express that. So for every aspect of the book, I had help with the research. So the parakeets, I went to the RSPB and I actually plotted. And I had another parakeet expert who actually didn't want to be named in my acknowledgements, actually. But he was a massive help. And I would email backwards and forth the dates, because I had to be quite, as well as having the spreadsheets on the sounds and the colours, I had to plot my entire book on a calendar from the date that the parakeets arrived on the street to when they nested, to when when they laid the eggs, the gestation of the eggs, the birth of the hatchlings, and then the date that Jasper dreaded, which was when they were going to fledge and leave the street. So I knew that my action had to be within that time period. So I had to plot it quite carefully. Like, you know, the action couldn't take place over 6 months because the baby parakeets obviously would have been long gone by then. And so the research was essential, really, to knowing that they actually left the trees and would go off to this big communal roost. So I did a lot of research into parakeets.
Yes, and that is the time frame that is ticking all the way behind Jasper, and in many ways the 48 hours that he has to solve the murder in the background.
He's dreading when the parakeets leave because it brings back his feelings of abandonment. His mother died, his nan died, and he has his feelings of rejection and loss and grieving, and he's so attached to the parakeets he sees them as the next thing that he holds so dear that he's going to leave him and wound him.
Now, I read the audiobook version, which is beautifully and very... Hugh Parmenter brings Jasper's voice to life.
He's amazing.
Incredibly. Did you have much to do with choosing him as a reader?
They emailed me a shortened version when they were looking at people to do the audiobook, and I loved his voice. I thought he really captured Jasper's innocence, and he has a very, very expressive voice, and he just really captured Jasper's innocence and vulnerability. So I said yes, I loved him, and I'd be really happy if they had him. And I was very, I was amazed that he accepted, and I was really thrilled with what he's done with the audiobook.
And what's wonderful for us is that it's been simultaneously published in audio and hardback, and your publisher has donated a copy to the RNIB Talking Books Library, which is fantastic.
Yeah, HarperCollins has been amazing. They've been brilliant.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I am, actually, particularly on car journeys. I like listening to them. So, I think it's an enjoyable experience. I read in hardback, paperback, on my Kindle, and audiobooks, so I guess it's a mixture when I experience books.
And I'm guessing with your educational journalistic background, you must be pretty passionate about making books accessible to all.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's so important. You know, I have two young sons, and I read to them at night and encourage them with their reading. It's just it's just so important, really. And I think I'm passionate about reading and encouraging people to read, and in whatever form, in audiobooks, in whatever form. I think it's just so important, really.
Sarah J. Harris, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Bea Larkham's murder was ice blue crystals with glittery edges and jagged silver icicles. That's what I told the first officer we met at the police station before Dad could stop me. I wanted to confess and get it over and done with. But he can't have understood what I said, or he forgot to pass on the message to his colleague who's interviewing me now. This man's asked me questions for the last 5 minutes and 22 seconds that have nothing to do with what happened to my neighbour, Bea Larkham, on Friday night.
Hugh Parmenter, narrating The Colours of Bea Larkham's Murder, written by my guest Sarah J. Harris. It's available now from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB703009. And throughout June, Read On will be broadcasting the podcasts that Sarah made to accompany the book. She'll also be back at the end of the show with the books of her life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later, poet Andrew Pettigrew will reveal why Louis Braille is his hero, and David Graham on Thunderbirds and Doctor Who. But first, another author who's written about experiencing the world differently is Candia McWilliam. Here's Robert Kirkwood to tell us more.
Candia McWilliam had just joined the judging panel of the Man Booker Prize for Fiction in 2006 when she started to lose her sight. The gradual onset of blindness seemed like an assault, especially tailored for someone whose life consisted of reading and writing. At first, she could only dictate, and the unfamiliar process unblocked a flow of memory and association concerning her childhood in Edinburgh, her mother's suicide, her teenage escape into another identity, finding and losing bearings in Cambridge and London, her marriages, her children, and stalking all of these, her increasing alcoholism.
A paper umbrella. One of the last things my mother gave me was a paper umbrella. It must have been from Japan. Its wooden spars were webbed with an oily paper that smelled of pine resin and fish. When you put the umbrella up, the paper separated from itself with a faint disgustingness of sound, unidentifiable as yet to a child of 8, that would later reveal itself to be that of flesh separating from flesh, or the frozen surface of a lake beginning to shiver apart. My paper umbrella was of little use in Edinburgh, a city with some call for the kind of umbrella that keeps off not the glare of the sun, but the fall of the rain. Nonetheless, I loved it. My mother was a woman with too many superstitions, a trait I have inherited, so she didn't like the umbrella to be put up inside the house. I didn't want to upset her, so I would stand just outside the house on the stone step under my orange paper umbrella, whirling it and looking up through its oily sections, listening to the seagulls mewing over our street. My mother shook silver in her pocket under the new moon, avoided looking at that moon through glass, said she wouldn't have hawthorn or peacock feathers in the house, and telephoned on our party line regularly to St. Anthony of Padua when she lost things. Or she tried to keep to these strictures. In fact, she seldom had silver in her pocket. The moon went where it wanted to go, and she found herself surprisingly often arranging the hawthorn in vases or making fancy dress outfits for me, with glittering many-eyed peacock feathers she had stolen from the zoo. St. Anthony I cannot speak for. So she knew what to avoid, but did not quite do it. Hers was a compressed life, folded back down into itself only shortly after it had apparently emerged into some kind of light. Nonetheless, in its shade, other lives have grown up, my own and those of my three children. I have the instinct, too, that she had many friends, though I do not know this, and that people who met her remembered having done so, but that might be wishful thinking of the sort we scatter on the young dead. Tomorrow, this book of mine, which is greatly hers, goes to the printer. It is an account of many kinds of light denied. It is also the account of how certain forms of shade are rich, if you are fortunate enough to stay sufficiently long to read them. I have already lived for 18 years longer than my mother did.
Candia McWilliam reading a part of her introduction to What to Look For in Winter, a memoir in blindness. The rest of the book is narrated by Sherry Baines. It's also available in Braille, and the print version is available in any good bookshop. After the recording of that, I spoke to Candia and she told me about the book.
I didn't ever think that I'd write an autobiography, because one of the
things about being a writer of fiction is that you want to keep yourself out of it. And then I had this peculiar experience, which was in 2006, when I was a judge on the Man Booker Prize for Fiction. I started to lose my sight, and I was so baffled by this, and so was every doctor whom I went to see, that I started wanting to capture the experience. And then I must confess that I thought I wanted to hold on to the last shreds and inklings of sight that I had left. And I wrote the first half of the book by dictating rather than by writing down, because I was what's called functionally blind, which meant that my eyes were fine, but my brain had closed them and it simply would not open them. And the second half of the book I wrote by holding my eyes open with my hands. So I typed very badly. I tapped slowly, a letter at a time, and my eyes grew very raw. And that's how the book was written. And I was, throughout that whole period, stone blind. My eyes just would not open. And then I have regained a measure of sight through surgical intervention, which the book describes, I hope not too disgustingly, but it's almost too macabre to go into here. Though I hope it's a story about how not seeing is, in a sense, a way of seeing, and of seeing differently. And as always with a story that's about words and about being human, it's how can we grow to understand one another. So it was an adventure inside my own head that was like becoming someone quite other than me, in a sense a privilege, in a sense a loss. And it isn't over, the adventure. And that is because, in spite of very frequently feeling like death, I didn't embrace it. And so I'm here to tell, I hope, the tale, and I hope further tales, which isn't me plugging any potential novels, it's just me hoping to connect with you, who I hope are listening.
No, we can't ignore the physical difficulties there were while writing the book, but emotionally, was it the hardest thing you've written?
That's a very difficult question to answer. And it's impossible to know, because art is, to a degree, emotion recollected in tranquility. And when you're doing the recalling, it feels as intense as anything else you have felt. So I'm not sure I could compare. In one way, it was much harder, which is I had to overcome my natural inhibition and flinching from about talking about myself, because the thing about an autobiography is you can't leave yourself completely out of it, though I must admit I have tried.
Now, you've both won awards and been on the judging panel of the Booker Prize. Tell us about the process, and how important are awards for writers?
I think they're happy accidents. I don't think that there's anything very rational about them at all. Very frequently, the winner of an award is chosen by compromise or horse trading. I don't think I'm telling you anything new when I tell you that. And they're very seldom completely unanimous. And it's lovely winning prizes, but I don't think you think any better of yourself. You just feel gratitude towards the accident of fate that's come your way. And so I'm pleased to have won prizes. And when I was a child, I used to enter competitions relentlessly just because I thought, well, why not? Very frequently, sort of competition that one could never possibly win because I have almost no skills. I do remember writing a letter to the Bunty, which was a comic, and I wrote a letter, and I think I was about six, saying my dog can lay the table. As you can imagine, that was, of course, a lie. And I was very sad when it wasn't published. And I badly wanted that prize, which was a pair of ballet shoes, because I was too fat to do ballet, but I thought I could sort of hold on to them and dream. And that's a prize that really would have mattered had I won it. So NB, anyone who's used to work for the Bunty in the 1960s, feel bad.
thanks once again to Candia McWilliam. What to Look For in Winter, A Memoir in Blindness is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. The introduction is narrated by Candia herself. The rest of the book is narrated by Sherry Baines. Head to www.rnib.org.uk/library. And of course, the print version is available wherever books are sold. A Case of Knives, A Little Stranger and Moving On are also available from RNIB.
Thanks to Candia McWilliam. Have you read a book that changed the way that you see the world? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the RNIB library? Why not drop us a line on the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bockingtook?
Bockingtook, yeah. It's Bockingtook. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake. And if...
Damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On. Still to come, David Graham looks back over his long career as a voice actor and the books of Sarah J. Harris's life. But first, Andrew Pettigrew is a young poet to listen out for. The 16-year-old, who attends the Royal Blind School in Morningside, was recently commended by the Poetry Society as one of the Foyle Young Poets of 2017. And it's not the first time that he's won plaudits for his poetry. Back in 2016, he was awarded the Pushkin Prize, as he told me down a not particularly good line from his home in South Lanarkshire.
The competition takes place in Scotland and St. Petersburg, and there's 12 winners. And I was one of those winners, and the prize was a week in Monyard Moor, which is just like creative writing retreat up in the north of Scotland.
And I believe that the prize was awarded to you by a very famous writer himself.
Yes, Ian Rankin, crime writer.
Who had some very complimentary things to say about the poem that you'd written about your hero, Louis Braille.
Yeah, I was back in 2015. I visited France to go to Louis Braille's birthplace and his home, and it was quite a moving experience. So I wrote a poem about, basically just about Louis Braille and how I admired him and how his invention of the language changed my life.
And one of the lines that I love in the poem is that reading is one of the things that unites all of us, whether we are sighted or blind, and that Braille enables blind people like you and me to be able to read still.
Yeah. And I think like Braille is so important and more not just a language, but allows us to be independent as well.
Absolutely.
Now, can you tell us a little bit more about the Foyle Online Poetry Anthology, please?
Basically, it's an international competition for young people to write poetry and send it in. I think there's like 12 overall winners, and I was one of the 100 commended winners. And the poem that I sent in was called Heaven in a Pub.
Now, I've read that, and being an Englishman, I was quite glad that there was a glossary for some of the terms that you use, including poke, which I believe means a paper bag.
Did you like the word tact as well?
I did indeed, yes. For people who haven't read it yet, and they will be able to get it via R&IB Bookshelf, can you tell us a bit about the poem?
Well, basically, I wrote this actually just before my National 5 English exam, just to stop studying for a single moment. It's basically about a guy who buys himself a fish supper, and then tragically that fish is stolen by a seagull, and it's the end of his world.
Did this reflect how you were feeling about your approaching Scottish higher exams?
Yeah, I would say so. I was the seagull, you steal the English exam and then you run away with it.
Now, you are a student at the Royal School for the Blind in Morningside in Edinburgh, and they've clearly been very supportive of your creative writing.
Yeah, I would say so. Like, my English teachers have always been really supportive, and like, just like all the support that you really get allows, like, gives you a sense of confidence and that you can do this. I never really felt like when I went to mainstream. Since last year, I've also been studying Latin, which makes me sound a lot smarter than I am. But my teacher keeps thinking that I'm the only Latin Braillist in the UK, but we don't actually know that. So if any of the listeners out there know a Latin Braillist, then get in touch with me.
Well, there's a challenge to our listeners. I think you're pretty unique, but let's hope that we are proved otherwise. Now, which poets have particularly influenced you as a poet yourself?
This is the least favourite question of my life, because shockingly, I've never really been a fan of reading poems, but I think my favourite is probably Roald Dahl and his Oompa Loompa songs, and Dr. Seuss.
Ah, yes, Dr. Seuss. Do you read prose then, of preference? Because I read somewhere that actually it was going blind that made you fall in love with reading.
Yeah, pretty much like when I was like 8 years old, and that's when my sight mostly went. I couldn't like play on the Xbox or play or watch the TV. So when I learned Braille, I started reading books and really loved it. And I started writing, because even before I lost my sight, I always wanted to be a writer. But Braille just made it so much easier, I guess.
And what do you most enjoy reading?
Usually like fantasy books or horror. But honestly, I think I'd read anything that comes under my fingers, apart from romance.
Well, there's plenty of time for that. So, is there a book that you have read recently that you would like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I suppose for my English exam, I read 1984 by George Orwell. And although that was just like reading for the course, I still really enjoyed it, because I think it's really relevant these days and it's really terrifying.
It certainly is. Andrew Pettigrew, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and the very best of luck in the future.
Thank you.
And here's Andrew Pettigrew reading Heaven in a Poke, which you can find in the Foyle Online Commended Anthology.
Heaven in a Poke. All right, I'm not very religious, but I can be a wee bit serious. And one thing's for sure, that be a bad day, there is no cure, except maybe to have a chippy, to get a bag of chips with a smack on my lips. Oh, it's heaven in a poke. But chips ain't enough to live on. There's something else that needs to be done. I think of love and care, a treat close by and all be so rare. and then I see her in the shop window, a breaded haddock all cooked and lovely, put the pennies down on the till, so starving them out to kill. Ah, oh, it's heaven in a poke. But now I've got my supper, just my fish and me, both out in the cold but happy as can be. We've got each other, we'll make it through. Oh, wee haddock, I need to tell you, I love you. With salt and vinegar, there's chips too, and a nice can of Iron Brew. Ah, oh, it's heaven in a poke. But wait just one moment, what's that above me? A wee body flying away and free. Out from a bin, tummy knee yet full, came charging out like a wee white bull. And with its grey wee mantle and its orange webbed feet, it stole me fish supper and I'm ready to greet. I'd say tears made, it cacked on my skull. Away you go, you bleeding seagull. Cause it isn't heaven in a poke ne mere.
Thanks again to Andrew Pettigrew. You can find his poem, Heaven in a Poke, in the Foyle Online Commended Anthology of 2017, which is available from the RNIB Bookshare service. For more information, visit the website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And if there is anyone else out there who reads Latin in Braille, do please drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On. Now, before we return to Sarah J. Harris for the books of her life, many of the best narrators in the business are to be found at the RNIB Talking Books Studios, but few have had such a long and distinguished career in voice acting as our next guest. Over to you, Robert.
In the small hours, Sir Alfred Milner, High Commissioner for South Africa and Lieutenant Governor of Cape Colony, was woken by a bright light in his eyes. He had a stateroom on the starboard side of the upper deck. It was 4 a.m., he noted in his diary, the small red diary, which was the only companion and confidant of his travels.
That's David Graham reading The Boer War by Thomas Pakenham, one of many books he's narrated for RNIB, although many listeners may be more familiar with him, sounding like this.
This is the stately home of Lady Penelope Creighton Ward. Parker speaking.
He's very well known for providing many voices for Gerry Anderson, including Parker and Brains in Thunderbirds, and was the co-inventor of the voice of the Daleks. And when he joined me in the Talking Book Studios, I asked him about his latest book.
It's called Lifting the Latch. It's a book narrated by a wonderful chap called Mont Abbott, who spent his whole life on the land in Oxfordshire. And he has total recall. It's about a dying world in a language that's dying out too. In fact, there's a glossary at the end of the book with words that you probably never have heard of. Hmm. But an absolutely wonderful character. Sang in the church choir, a wonderful voice, never made much money, had two terrible accidents in his life which badly affected him, two tragedies, I would say, but indestructible. I admired him so much at the end of the book. He's a hero of mine now.
Now, it sounds like quite a challenging book to do.
It was a very challenging book because I had to work on the accent. And the syntax, he had dictated the book to a lady who got it in all order. But he had wonderful memory, almost total recall. It wasn't an easy book to read. But it was well worth the effort that you just have to put into books. You prepare them.
Mm.
A lot of the work goes in preparation, you know, and it's not easy to read books, but it's very rewarding, I find.
How long have you been reading for RNIB now?
Oh, I mean, at least 25, maybe 30 years, I think. I started in the old studios in Great Portland Street when we recorded on tape, which was much, much more laborious than these days in state-of-the-art studios and, you know.
Now, are there any books in that 25 years that really stand out?
Well, I would say this one does for a start, Lifting the Latch. But I've read so many. There was a book on the history of the State of Israel by a famous English Jewish historian.
Mm.
They give me books which have Jewish references because I was born Jewish and, you know, I know quite a lot about it.
Mm.
When I enjoy reading them. But I must have read, I don't know, getting on for hundreds, you know, I don't know how many books I've read. It's difficult to recall particular ones. But I finished the Lifting the Latch and I'm reading this book about, it's a children's book really, very funny and imaginative, about two young kids who come across a weird machine on their travels. So I've just started that as well, which is, it's a doddle compared with the other book.
Now, some children will know your voice because you're Grandpa Pig in Peppa Pig.
Yes, that's right, and the wise old elf in Ben and Holly. And my voice career goes back a long way, starting with Gerry Anderson. And then I created the original Dalek voices too, with an actor called Peter Hawkins many, many years ago, I think in 1962, Doctor Who. And I also appeared in two of the stories in Vision as an actor.
Yeah, because you go right back to the very beginning almost of Doctor Who. The episode Daleks was in 1963, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then I did The Gunfighters, which I think was in black and white, with the first Doctor Who, where I played a cowardly barman, and it's become a very well-known one.
Mm.
And then I did another story with Tom Baker, which I played a Russian. It was City of Death, but it was a nice part. I had to age up, so from sort of middle age to old age. So they had to take me out and put me in front of a camera and then do a bit more so that it all came up in a flash, you see.
Yeah. Now, the voice of the Daleks is iconic. How did you actually come up with it?
Well, it was done in the old Lime Grove Studios in Shepherd's Bush. We just played around with it. I did it with a chap called Peter Hawkins, now sadly not alive anymore, an old friend of mine. And he was a marvellous voice man too. He did the Flowerpot Men and all sorts of stuff. We came at it from the approach that it needed to be stylized and menacing.
Hmm.
And then they fed the voice through a synthesizer. So it made it even more menacing and, you know. So it went like something like that. That fouls. You know, that was that sort of stuttery thing.
Hmm.
And it seemed to work because they've gone down in vocal history, haven't they?
Now, you're also very well known for playing both Brains Parker and Gordon Tracy in the Thunderbolts.
Yes.
How did that association with Jenny Anderson come about?
Well, that's a long time ago. It was in the 50s, if you can believe it. I was doing a television film down at Elstree and in a pretty ropey script, and by one of those lovely accidents of fate, Gerry Anderson happened to be directing. And in between takes, I was playing some villain on the run. He mentioned that he was about to go into animation and puppet voices, cartoon voices. And I pricked up my ears at this. Well, I said, you know, I'm not bad at doing accents and voices. And if you do anything, I'd like to be considered. And about, I don't know, it was about 6 months later, he took my number and he phoned me And then I ended up by doing five series for him, beginning with Four Feather Falls, then Supercar, Fireball XL5, Stingray, and the big one, Thunderbirds.
Mm.
So it had a big effect on my career. But of course, parallel to that, I was working in the theatre and in television, and then I was a member of Laurence Olivier's company at the National Theatre before the new building for 2 years, and that was a wonderful experience, and toured with them in Australia in The Front Page, and worked with Laurence Olivier in a play called Saturday, Sunday, Monday, with Franco Zeffirelli, and I did other plays in the West End, Arturo Uy, which is a famous Brecht play, and then two plays with Leonard Rossiter, the great Leonard Rossiter, who played in Arturo Uy, and then in Make and Break, a Michael Frayn play. You know, so, you know, I've kept dotting about from radio to the theatre and television. You know, I've had my ups and downs, all actors do, but I've been lucky. You know, you've got to take your opportunities, and, you know, sometimes you meet the right people, and it has a terrific effect on your career.
You were Big Brother in the 1984 Apple advert. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was Ridley Scott. I mean, that came out of left field. I mean, I went to see him because I don't do... I do voiceovers, commercials, but I haven't done many visuals. And I went up and he said he was casting Big Brother, and they picked me out to do it. And when I arrived at the studio, they gave me a page of script. And I said, why didn't you send it to me? I can't learn this. So they wrote it all up. And they dressed me in this sort of, they plastered my hair down, and I wore two pairs of glasses. And I ended up reading it off a crib, you know. You wouldn't notice it, but it became very famous. And they show it every year at the Super Bowl in America, which is a big American football game. And then I cop a few repeats over the years, which has been great. Good luck and cheerio.
There are many books narrated by David Graham in the Talking Books Library, including Lifting the Latch by Sheila Stewart. Available now. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Thanks to Robert and to David Graham. Now it's back to Sarah J. Harris for the books of her life. So, Sarah, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become a writer?
I loved The Walls of Libby Chase by Joan Aitken, and the world that Joan Aitken drew me into, the two girls and the wolves. It was just such a brilliant, brilliant book, and the plot just sucked me in, and it did make me... I'd always wanted to be a writer, actually, since I was a child. Very young, actually, I would be writing in notebooks, and I tried to get my first book published when I was seven. So I did look up to writers like Joan Aitken when I was a child.
It was dusk, winter dusk. Snow lay white and shining over the pleated hills, and icicles hung from the forest trees. Snow lay piled on the dark road across Willoughby Wold. But from dawn, men had been clearing it with brooms and shovels. There were hundreds of them at work, wrapped in sacking because of the bitter cold and keeping together in groups for fear of the wolves, grown savage and reckless from hunger. Snow lay thick, too, upon the roof of Willoughby Chase, the great house that stood on an open eminence in the heart of the Wold. But for all that, the Chase looked an inviting home, a warm and welcoming stronghold. Its rosy herringbone brick was bright and well cared for. Its numerous turrets and battlements stood up sharp against the sky, and the crenellated balconies, corniced with snow, each held a golden square of window. The house was all alight within, and the joyous hubbub of its activity contrasted with the sombre sighing of the wind and the hideous howling of the wolves without.
Charlotte Strevens narrating The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, written by Joan Aitken, which is TB17635. Braille and giant print copies are also available.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'd like to reread Eleanor Oliphant's Completely Fine. It's just a brilliant, brilliant book. And it's the voice is so strong. Somebody who is a bit different, who's just going through, seeing the life through her eyes. I've just found a really moving experience. And it is a book I can read and reread again and again.
One of the designers was finishing up today. As usual, we'd be marking the occasion with cheap wine and expensive beer, crisps dumped in cereal bowls. With any luck, it would start early so I could show my face and still leave on time. I simply had to get to the shops before they closed. I pushed open the door, the chill of the aircon making me shudder, even though I was wearing my jerkin. Billy was holding court. He had his back to me and the others were too engrossed to notice me slip in.
"She's mental," he said.
"Well, we know she's mental," Janie said. "That was never in doubt. The question is, what did she do this time?"
Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman is available in Braille, giant print and as TB701915. It's narrated by Kathleen McCarran. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I loved The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stuart Turton. I thought this was a brilliant, amazing, amazing book. So clever, so different to anything I'd ever read before. The way he plotted it, I did think it is a work of genius, actually. It really blew me away. And it's the one book, actually, that my husband and I were competitively reading. I was reading in hardback. No, actually, I was reading on the Kindle and my husband was reading in hardback. And we were reading it at the same time, which we haven't done before. I really thoroughly enjoyed this book and would heartily recommend it.
Did you finish together?
We did. We were quite competitive, though, to see who could get further ahead.
Sarah J. Harris, thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with the Read On listeners.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stuart Turton is on sale wherever you buy your books, with a talking book version on its way to the library soon. Thanks again to Sarah J. Harris. Don't forget to tune in to Read On next week to hear the first of her podcasts telling the story behind The Colours of B. Larkham's Murder. And the book is available now in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.